From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, writer and director Judd Apatow and actor Seth Rogen from the movie Knocked Up. The new comedy is about a lovely young woman who meets an oafish slacker. After a one-night stand, she becomes pregnant and he becomes a father. Critic A.O. Scott calls it rowdy, sad, and very funny. Which, we might add, is much like Apatow's previous hit film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Anchors and Anvils, the second album by Avi LaVere, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Ralph Ellison by Arnold Rampersad. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new comedy Knocked Up, from the creator of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, opens tomorrow. It's written and directed by Judd Apatow and stars actor and writer Seth Rogen. Today on Fresh Air, we talk to them both. Apatow started out doing stand-up comedy as a teenager and also hosted a high school radio show in which he interviewed comedians he admired. For a while, he wound up working in television, very good television. He wrote and directed for The Larry Sanders Show, co-created The Ben Stiller Show, then went on to two other outstanding cult comedies, Freaks and Geeks, and his own creation, Undeclared. He produced the movies The Cable Guy with Jim Carrey and Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy with Will Ferrell, then took his first stab at writing and directing a movie himself. It was The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which made Steve Carell a star and Apatow a hot property. Seth Rogen was a supporting player in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and both a writer and co-star on Undeclared, and, at an even younger age, one of the cast members of Freaks and Geeks. Apatow befriended and championed Rogen early. Like Apatow, Rogen also dared to venture into stand-up comedy as a young teen. Now Rogen is front and center in Apatow's new film, Knocked Up. He plays Ben, a young slacker who has a drunken one-night stand with a beautiful woman named Allison, played by Katherine Heigl from Grey's Anatomy. Both are shocked when it turns out that Allison becomes pregnant. Here they are on their second date, having dinner at a restaurant, with Ben trying clumsily to make a good second impression.
I thought maybe we could just talk and get to know each other better.
Cool. Okay, I'll start. I'm Canadian.
Oh, that's cool.
From Vancouver. I live here illegally, actually. Don't tell anyone. But it works out in my advantage, I think, ultimately, because I don't have to pay any taxes. So financially, that's helpful. Because I don't have a lot of money, you know. I mean, I'm not poor or anything, but I eat a lot of spaghetti.
So, you know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
So how do you...
How do I pay rent? When I was in high school, I got ran over by a postal truck.
Oh, my God.
It was my foot more than anything. But I got like 14 grand from the British Columbia government.
Right.
And that really lasted me. I mean, until now. I mean, it's been almost 10 years. I have like 900 bucks left. So that should last me for like, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, but like another 2 years.
In the current issue of Newsweek, David Anson raved about Rogen's performance and wrote that having him as the leading man was, quote, casting as against the grain as Dustin Hoffman seemed back in the day of The Graduate. I asked Judd Apatow what he thought about that comparison.
I'm obviously a big Mike Nichols fan, and The Graduate is a touchstone film. And I remember I was out on the road with Owen Wilson. We were writing a movie many years ago, which we didn't get made. But we sat in a hotel room, and I can't say we were sober, and we watched The Graduate, and I outlined it as it was playing so I could understand why it was so good. I didn't understand that, you know, there was so little exposition. They explained so little about the characters, and I was fascinated with that. And so the fact that people are saying nice things about Seth, comparing to him to another unconventionally handsome Jew.
Exactly.
is wonderful.
Judd, why did you want to make this movie? Why these themes?
I always wanted to make a movie about having kids because every time my wife and I went through the process, something heinous would happen. A doctor wouldn't show up, or a doctor would yell at us, or a nurse would be rude, or it just always felt like we wanted it to be the most pleasant experience that we would remember forever, and the karma would swing back and say, you cannot control this. And I always knew that these things that were happening, although painful at the time, were very, very funny. And I obviously wanted to write about marriage and children and what that's all about. But, you know, for me, I just really took to the idea of Seth having to go through a lot of things that I went through. What it's like looking at the gynecologist before his hand enters your girlfriend. all those moments where you find out someone's pregnant and you're in a panic and you don't know if you can handle the future that lies ahead. I just thought Seth going through this is the funniest thing ever. and through that story, I could expand out and talk about relationships.
Judd, what gave you the confidence to cast Seth as a leading man in the first place?
Self-sabotage.
Exactly. It's not comp, it's masochism.
You know, we've been working together since Seth was 16, which always sounds wrong to say.
Exactly. It sounds very intimately.
Sounds like I'm a member of the Man Boy Love Association or something. But Seth came in and read for Freaks and Geeks back in 98, and I just thought, this is a very strange young man. This guy really makes me laugh, and I don't know what it is about him, but he had this very deep Canadian voice back then.
I had a really thick accent.
But... yeah, that's slowly disappeared. But as we did more episodes of Freaks and Geeks, I noticed that Seth was able to carry emotional storylines while still having this very caustic sense of humor. And I remember after watching one particular episode where he had a girlfriend and he discovered that she had been born with ambiguous genitals. Yes, that was what the episode was about.
Yes.
This is on NBC.
This was prime time.
Yes, this is on Freaks and Geeks. We still don't know why we were canceled. But but it was really kind of a beautiful episode. It was nominated for all sorts of awards and things. But for its sensitivity, one would not expect that.
No.
And I thought Seth really carried it. And afterwards, I thought, I bet you this guy could carry a movie. This is a movie star in the same, you know, universe of people that I like John Candy and Albert Brooks and people like that.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, because that's the episode that, as a TV critic, really stood out to me as being bold back then. And I'd like to play a little chunk from it get your reactions to it. It's a scene where Seth, as Ken Miller, confides in his friends about that secret. You've already said what the secret is, that his new girlfriend has told him. The friends are played by James Franco and Jason Segel, both of whom are in Knocked Up. So let's play the clip. Here we go.
Okay. Look, I'm going to tell you guys something now, and you have to promise not to be jerks about it and not to tell anyone ever, okay?
Yeah, that's cool, man.
Amy's not really a girl.
What?
I mean, you know, she's a girl, but she's kind of part guy, too.
What's that mean?
It means that when she was born, she was packing both a gun and the holster.
Well, does she still have, you know, the gun?
Oh, the doctors took care of it.
Okay. Well, then she's a girl. I don't think it works that way. I think you better get rid of her.
I don't want to break up with her. Yeah, I really like her. I might even love her.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that mean you're gay?
I don't know. Does it?
I was joking.
Oh.
Seth, what do you remember about filming that scene?
I remember thinking this was the weirdest idea ever that I couldn't believe. It's funny because the episode was actually like brought up like really close to the beginning of when we started shooting. I mean, John Kasdan, co-wrote the episode, and he's around my age. He's actually only like a year older than I am, so we kind of became friends, and we'd hang out, and he'd talk about it a lot, and I just remember thinking, like, we're not going to do that. That sounds crazy. Like, they're not actually going to do that. And then they actually did do it, and it's funny listening to it. It made me realize Freaks and Geeks should have been a radio play.
It works so well.
It works really well like that.
It was a controversial episode with the staff. I had heard someone talking about this topic on Howard Stern one morning, and it struck me that we could do a sweet episode about tolerance and also show how freaked out someone like Seth would get. And a lot of the writing staff got really mad at me because they thought that it would just be either maudlin or just so awful that we would never, ever be able to live it down. And it actually, you know, it came out very well. Mainly, I mean, you could tell in that radio performance. It's an amazing performance by Seth. And even hearing that, it makes me understand, you know, what I saw in him way back then.
Judd, I think maybe the boldest thing you did in this movie, even though you're getting an awful lot of credit for casting Seth, is casting your wife and kids in the movie. And it looks like you're going to get away with it. I mean, they're terrific in it, but wasn't that a big risk to do that all in the same film and give them so much to do?
Well, it was a risk to my marriage. But my wife is a hilarious woman. She never thinks of herself as funny necessarily. And
we should say it's Leslie Mann who plays Debbie in the movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, yes. You know, people know her as the drunk driver in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and she was in Big Daddy and The Cable Guy. She's just hilarious, but she also has this very raw method acting De Niro spirit to her. She's not messing around. She's really going there. Mm-hmm. When we shot the movie, Paul Rudd really thought that she hated him, and she tried to explain to him, no, I hate Judd.
And you're Judd right now.
So that wasn't a difficult decision, and we had talked a lot about things from our lives and people that we knew that made us laugh about marriage and the obstacles to getting along over the long term. So I knew that would be exciting, especially since it was fun working with her on The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Hiring the kids was an idea that I came up with, you know, probably partially inspired by old John Cassavetes movies where people would be playing a scene and his kids would just be running around and it made it feel more real, almost like a documentary. And I think that kids in movies are generally pretty terrible because you don't believe that that's that woman's kid and they're stiff and scripted. And I've worked with kids and it's pretty tricky to make it seem natural. And the key to the movie was to really see what a family feels like so Seth can see his future. So I knew this would be a good idea, and I knew my kids were adorable and very funny.
How old were your daughters at the time of the filming?
They were 8 and 3. But I had a... So anyway, I kind of asked my wife's permission. I kept asking her, but saying, you know, don't worry about it, honey. You don't have to answer now, but think about it. It might be a good idea. Think about it. And then about a week before shooting, she claims I said, well, we have to have him. I don't have anyone else. What are we going to do?
We're shooting in a week.
So she claims I manipulated her into it. So I was just very careful during the shoot to have the set pre-lit before the kids arrived.
Yeah.
I would buckle them into a chair for, say, a scene where they're eating. I would not feed them much before the scene, put a lot of food in front of them, and I knew that when they were done eating the bacon, they would ask to leave, and that I would not be allowed to force them to stay.
It's like how you get a tiger to work in movies. With food.
And slowly my daughter Maud got very, very good at it, to the point where right now I'm trying to convince her that she was terrible in the movie, so she will not pursue this.
Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen, collaborators on the new comedy film Knocked Up. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my conversation with Judd Apatow, the writer and director of Knocked Up, and Seth Rogen, the film's star. It opens tomorrow and features many of the actors from Apatow's TV series Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared. Seth, it's true, I guess, that the guys playing your best friends in the movie are your best friends in real life.
Yeah, pretty much.
So does that make filming easier or just more fun or take longer or what?
I don't know if easier is the word. It makes it more fun just to hang out with your friends. And I guess it does make it easier to kind of have that natural rapport and banter with people. I mean, it's funny that in the movie, Martin's the guy with the beard and everyone makes fun of him, because in real life, that's exactly how it is when we're all together, everyone makes fun of Martin. And it's just kind of nice being able to have those kind of dynamics in the movie. For us, it just makes it really fun. And I don't know if it reads at all, that's a bonus. But
I mean, for me, the reason to do that was because I'm lazy.
Yeah.
And I could just tap into a dynamic that already exists, as opposed to using creativity.
Yes.
I could just tap into the natural comedy of these guys giving each other a hard time. The only person that it was really hard on was my wife, Leslie Mann, who's in the movie, because she would have to, sit with all of them in these scenes, and in between takes, there's literally no difference between shooting and not shooting. And so while they're lighting, she has to sit there while they discuss fetish porno websites.
It's true. We keep talking about this, what we were talking about after they cut. That's what I would notice. I'd be like, we could just keep rolling right now. It's sad. Is that sad? It's embarrassing a little. I shouldn't be admitting that.
Well, in terms of improvisation, I guess this is a question for Judd in terms of framing it. When you've got these people who know each other so well and like each other so much, and you've got to film and build upon and write around their improv, how do you go about doing it? How many drafts are there? How much, what's the shooting ratio? How do you get the creativity out of them and then get it back from yourself to them?
Well, it's not a rushed process. It starts very early. I finished writing the screenplay for this movie in 2005. I had a draft, and I immediately get as many actors as I can who I know I'm going to put in the movie, and I have them read it out loud and rehearse. So about six, seven months before we shoot, I'm already rehearsing a little bit to see if I'm on the right track and to figure out some character details that are left open. And then, by the time we get to shooting, we've table read a few times and we've done a lot of rehearsals. So we love the script and we're really happy. But it's always better if I can tell the actors that after a few takes, it really can move in other directions. Because when they surprise each other, that's when you get all sorts of real moments, and that's when the magic happens. A lot of times the things that they're improvising are things that we've already worked on in rehearsals or ideas that came up during auditions. I'll yell things out, ideas I think of in the moment. I always know the beginning, middle, and end of every scene and what I need to get out of it. But I find that the details can change. So if I have Katherine Heigl telling Seth that she's pregnant for the first time, I have a couple of funny lines that Seth could say, but I know that the best one will probably be the eighth one that Seth says off the top of his head when he's not thinking about it too much.
In terms of filming improv scenes, Seth, there's one in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is, I guess, a famous example of what you can do with improv. It's the waxing scene. Can you talk about how you filmed that and prepared for that, and how you guys reacted once the cameras stopped?
That is a good example of just kind of, our little mantra of what would you do, as Stanislavski said. We just put many cameras on it. There was a lot of talk about that day leading up to it and how, exactly it would go down, and Judd just said, we'll do it. We'll just do it. We'll just wax him with six cameras filming it, and he told us just to react, exactly how we would react. There's absolutely no acting going on there. I mean, we are watching Steve Carell get waxed, who's in a lot of pain, and it was disgusting, and we reacted. Yet it was very hilarious to watch, and that's a very good, that's a good example of just, why try to script that? That's all I would say.
For a minute, it becomes a snuff film.
Exactly. It's like watching Jackass. But why try to script that? What are you going to think of that will be as funny as your actual reaction when watching a man get his hair ripped off? So, that's a very good example of judges kind of trusting everyone to react naturally and, hope that, that would be funny. And in that situation, it definitely was to me.
Talk about your co-star, Katherine Heigl. I really like her. I think she's one of the best actors on Grey's Anatomy. And I was impressed here by how much she committed to both the comedy and the reality in her scenes. What was it like to act against her?
It was awesome, I have to say. I mean, she's tall, physically speaking, and she's loud, kind of, and she's just like a real presence. Like, you know, I'm a loud kind of big guy, you know, and I can curse, and I'm just, if you have a small actress against me, then it might just look like I'm going to eat them or sit on them or just do something terrible to them. But she really scared me. I mean, she really put me on my heels, and she's a lot, you know, smarter than I am in a lot of ways. So it was great. It made it so it was a real, you know, balance. You know, it was important to us going in that, you know, it wasn't too one-sided. It wasn't always like she was wrong and I was right or the other way around. It really had to be viewed, you know, from both sides of the situation. And, she was just really strong and could really articulate her point of view well. So it made it great for me. And I remember thinking, like, I could be a lot funnier with her just because, you know, I can scream and curse at her and she can just bring it right back and it will really just up the volume and anger of the entire movie.
Mm-hmm. Seth Rogen and Judd Apatow, the star and writer-director, respectively, of Knocked Up. More of our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation during National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org. From Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections, at pewpublicsafety.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, starting out in comedy. We continue our conversation with writer-director Judd Apatow and actor Seth Rogen from the new film Knocked Up. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the second album by Amy Levere, and Maureen Corrigan tells us about a new biography of Ralph Ellison, which she calls authoritative and vivid. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. We're talking with Judd Apatow, the writer-director of the new comedy Knocked Up, and Seth Rogen, who stars in the film. They also collaborated on the film The 40-Year-Old Virgin. They first started working together when Apatow cast Rogen in the critically acclaimed but short-lived series Freaks and Geeks. Rogen went on to write and act in Apatow's next show, Undeclared. Seth, did you learn anything from your experience in the TV shows that carried over into film in terms of your acting or even your writing or your improv?
Yeah, I mean, all those things, without a doubt. I mean, I feel like if you watch Freaks and Geeks and pay attention only to me, as I do, you can pretty much chart the growth of my acting ability and comfort level from episode to episode. I mean, if we had shot, I mean, it just so happened we shot that hermaphrodite episode, like near the end. If that was near the beginning, we would not be here right now talking. Judd would not have thought I should put that guy in a movie. He would have thought, why did I take him out of Canada? And, you know, it was just, I grew immensely more. I mean, that was literally the first acting I ever did. I grew way more comfortable in front of the camera as we went on and just kind of learned how to do it. And then Undeclared, I really learned how to write. I mean, I felt like I could write funny dialogue at that point, but I really didn't understand, you know, structuring a story, you know, looking at the emotional side of it first and then kind of filling in the humor holes as needed. And that's something Judd really, you know, taught me how to do. And we, you know, to this day, when me and Evan are writing, we talk about things that, you know, Judd told me during Undeclared days. You know, I mean, that was really, we all called it comedy college. And it really felt like that. Mm-hmm. It was really all the writers and actors learning, you know, how to be funnier.
And you know, the culmination, I think, of all of that work is that Seth and his partner Evan wrote this movie called Superbad that Seth is in it. It plays a cop, and Bill Hader is from Saturday Night Live, is another cop. But it stars Jonah Hill and Michael Cera, Michael Cera from Arrested Development. And it's a really filthy but very sweet high school movie, and it's something that Seth started writing when he was 15, and we would table read it during Undeclared, and we never could get anyone to make it because people were just not up for making an R-rated high school movie. But in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm very, very happy that it's coming out after Knocked Up because it's so freaking funny. I really think that Knocked Up would pale.
No.
it wouldn't be received in exactly the same way because this Superbad movie just rips the house down in a way that, for me, just as a comedy fan, I haven't seen in forever. I literally cannot think of a movie that gets laughs this big, and I think it actually works like the best possible Freaks and Geeks episode if Freaks and Geeks was really going as hard as it could at comedy also. And that, you know, that's a lot of the result of Seth being a writer for Undeclared. Yeah. And being a producer on 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up.
How important is the R?
It's all about the R.
All about the R.
You know, I think that life is R.
Yeah.
If we followed you home, within 15 minutes, some of your behavior would put your life into an R rating.
Exactly.
So there's
for
no
me,
way
it'd be 30 seconds.
You know, there's no way to show honest human behavior with a PG 13. You can do something very funny and creative, and I've worked in that rating, and I'm proud of the work. But if you really want to be realistic, you fall into the R very quick, and you can't show how people get pregnant. How the baby comes out, the fights you get in when you're pregnant, when you say awful things, it just all instantly is an R. So we enjoy it because we just think it allows us to show things as they are. At least in our dirty little life experience.
Exactly.
Maybe William F. Buckley's life is clean.
No, maybe not.
You know.
Seth, with Superbad, if you started writing it when you were 15.
Yeah.
And you actually became a writer, even on Undeclared, weren't you on the staff of that before you were 21?
Yeah, I was 18 when we did that.
So, I mean, you hear a lot about child actors in Hollywood, but you actually have a legitimate claim to being a child writer.
I guess so, huh? What does that mean?
How did you get started so young, and what got you so interested in actually putting jokes to page?
I just loved comedy, you know? I knew that was what I had to do when I got older. As soon as it became clear that you didn't have to get an actual job and that there were people out there getting paid to just kind of be funny, that's all I wanted to do. So there was really no other option. I really had no other career ambition in any way. I've never had another job. I've literally never done anything other than this. I started doing stand-up when I was 13 at my parents' encouragement. You know, a lot of people's parents wouldn't encourage that. It's funny, when me and Evan were actually writing Superbad, I would always, his mom thought we were wasting our time. Like, admittedly, she'll talk about it still. She really thought we were completely wasting our time. And my mother would encourage us to write, you know, into the wee hours of the morning if, you know, we were enjoying it. So I think, you know, my parents really had a lot to do with me having the confidence to actually, you know, try to do any of this stuff.
How do you do stand up at 13? I mean, who are you standing up in front of and how are you getting
it? I'd go to bars and stuff. You could go to bars. You're allowed to perform in bars. I would have to leave immediately after, generally speaking. But I was embraced by the other comics in Vancouver. They really liked me. And I think it's because I didn't try to use my age as a gimmick. I tried to speak honestly about things I was going through, but I always hoped that these jokes would be funny, you know, if a 30-year-old was saying them or a 13-year-old was saying them. I just tried to be honest. I knew that was kind of my one thing I had that the other comics didn't, is that, you know, anyone can talk about what they went through when they were 13 or 14, but I actually was 13 or 14, so it kind of gave me a little, you know, extra insight maybe. But it was all about my grandparents, you know, and my bar mitzvah and trying to touch nipples and women and just kind of, you know, real. I try to be as honest as humanly possible, really.
Jed, we talked about Seth getting an early start in terms of comedy. You did too. How did you get interested and what led you to it?
Well, my grandmother was friends with this comedian named Toadie Fields, who was one of the first really edgy Joan Rivers-like comedians. And so when I was a kid, when I was about 10 years old, we used to go see her do stand-up at the Westbury Music Fair on Long Island. And it seemed like a pretty good way to make a living. She had just had diabetes and had her leg amputated, and she was doing this big comeback tour. And she...
That's a lot of material.
Yeah. And she talked about losing her leg, and she was really happy and got standing ovations. And I think somewhere deep in my psyche, I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Because I felt like a legless person.
A legless diabetic.
So, I mean, for me, I was like, wow, that's pretty powerful stuff. And I think that's what lit the fuse.
Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen, collaborators on the new comedy film Knocked Up. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my conversation with writer-director Judd Apatow and actor-writer Seth Rogen. Their new film, Knocked Up, opens tomorrow. Seth, describe your style of acting.
Well, or lack thereof. I really just, you know, try to be real, you know? I mean, that's pretty much my main priority when I'm doing these things is just... How would this go down, you know? What would this be like if it was actually happening, you know? I try to think of it like...
That's an Uta Hagen book. How would it go down?
Yeah, exactly. Was that Stanislavski? Did he say that? How would you do this? Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like I need to create, you know, odd affectations in order to feel like I'm giving a performance, you know, or, you know, I don't need to limp or have a monocle or something like that. It just doesn't, to me, that isn't what makes it, you know, challenging or interesting to me. I really just, I just try to make it seem real. I just, you know, ideally I don't want people to even think about the acting, you know. I don't want to give, I just want to, I think of it as a writer more than anything, I think. When mm-hmm. I read the script, I think, if I had written this, what would I want these actors to do to bring this story to life? And that's basically all I do. I mean, I just try to serve the story while improvising many genitalia-related jokes.
And for, you know, the best compliment we've ever received was when Freaks and Geeks was on the air. Somebody, maybe it was you,
yeah,
said that it was almost a voyeuristic experience. Like you were watching something that you shouldn't be watching.
Yeah.
And on some level, everything we're doing is trying to emulate a movie like The Last Detail.
Yeah.
The Hal Ashby movie, wow, where mm-hmm. you just believe that it's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
I want people to forget that I exist, and I don't want people to be paying attention to any of the cinematic construction. I'm just trying to trick them into believing this reality level. I always go back and watch Tootsie, which is a movie that is very simply shot, but effective. And Fast Times at Ridgemont High is another movie that it's shot in a simple but incredibly effective way. And, you know, we have a couple of rules. No push-ins.
Yeah.
No craning down from tree branches.
Exactly. But, you know, I will say, like, going into this, the one real thought I had that I'd never had before going into a movie was, like, how do I make sure I don't really annoy people, A? And how do I make it that people believe that a woman would actually want to talk to me? So I actually thought of movies like Albert Brooks movies and Woody Allen movies and just thought, like, how do these Jews pull it off? That's literally what it was. It was like, Albert Brooks doesn't really annoy people. How does he do that? Woody Allen seems to get hot girls. How does he pull that off? And there was actually, if there was any thought I put into the movie, it was how to do those two things.
And then finally, one last question for Judd. In the Freaks and Geeks DVD set, in the booklet that came with it, you wrote, let me quote here, "I shall use the warm feelings that this country showers on this show to prolong my career well past the point where I have stopped making comedy work." And I just wondered, are we there yet?
We are so close. I was saying to somebody this morning, I'm so, you know, everything about comedy for most people, but especially me, is based on feeling unappreciated and insecure, feeling like a freak, if you will. And the amount of positive reaction that we've been getting to the work pretty much guarantees that the rest of my work for the rest of my career will be awful.
It'll suffer.
It'll beyond suffer. I will lose all connection with my crowd and just be writing a movie about my relationship with my housekeeper.
Okay. You're like if Kafka won the lottery.
Yes.
Well, I don't buy that for a second. I love the work you guys have done together and the work I hope you keep doing together. Judd Apatow, Seth Rogen, thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer-director Judd Apatow and actor Seth Rogen of the new comedy movie Knocked Up. It opens tomorrow. Amy Levere has developed simultaneous careers as a singer and an actress. She played the rockabilly singer Wanda Jackson in the Johnny Cash biopic Walk the Line and had a small role in director Craig Brewer's Black Snake Moan earlier this year. Now she's released her second album called Anchors and Anvils. It's produced by Jim Dickinson, who has worked with everyone from Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones to The Replacements. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Wasn't with her, he would say. They fought through the morning and all of the day. She'd have to kill him to get him to stay. Killing him didn't make the love go away. Killing him didn't make the love go away. Killing him didn't make the love go away. Killing him didn't make the love go away.
Amy Levere gets things off with a bang on Anchors and Anvils with Killing Him, a revenge song in which a woman who sounds suspiciously like a stand-in for Amy Levere says she murdered her duplicitous boyfriend. But, as she says in the wistful refrain, killing him didn't make her love go away. And if it's one thing Amy Levere knows from, it's wistfulness. Her languid voice drips the stuff.
Where does it end? Where to begin? Who are your friends? Who are your foes? You'll never know long as you go. Pointless drinking till it sounds like they're all speaking poorly in Spanish. Who do you wish would totally vanish? It's only and all you can do. I'm not an actor, but I act like I am. I really am awful, but I act like I'm not. Pretending my days hold the value of gold when they only hold one.
Like the recent song from another Amy, Amy Winehouse, and her tune Rehab, LaVere sings about substance abuse habits that she understands aren't good for her, but which help numb the pain of bad romance. In other words, that song's title, Pointless Drinking, gets it slightly wrong. There is a point to her drinking, it's just not very healthy. Maybe this is one reason Jim Dickinson, producer of bad boy dissolutes like The Replacements and Big Star, as well as a keyboardist who's accompanied Aretha Franklin and the Rolling Stones, was drawn to LaVere's music. She's a philosophical screw-up who likes a little walking on the wild side, with fiddles.
Lost in a trance as I went on my way. I heard a backbeat, let a weird, weird beat. Everywhere I put my feet, well, it all started about a week ago when my lover told me.
That's Amy LaVere covering an obscure Carla Thomas tune called That Beat. Like much of the album's music, it makes a hash of different genres, mixing R&B with country and a loping rock and roll, with a variety of time signatures, such as the waltz and the blues. Amy LaVere was born in the Southwest, has lived in Detroit and Nashville, and now Memphis, which is where she connected with producer Dickinson. He brings out the best in her voice, which is tiny and delicate, even as her phrasing is wry and barbed.
I found a bow and a little wooden arrow in a store that was full of nothing that I was there for. I bought it for a song I had saved up in a pocket, and I tucked it in my coat like a sniper with a rocket. I walked around the cold, cold town, just a maiden on a mission, consumed with ideas of revenge and redemption. But you gotta learn to shoot first if you're aiming to kill.
As an actress, LaVere has yet to really prove herself. She barely registered as brassy Wanda Jackson in Walk the Line. But as a singer in her own eclectic style, Amy LaVere uses anchors and anvils to establish herself as a Sly Boots, a throwback to pre-rock styles who nonetheless fits right into the cut-up, patchwork, assemblage pop culture we all live in right now.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Anchors and Anvils by Amy LaVere.
I've forgotten all the rest. You to me were true. You to me were the best. When there is no more, you cut to the core. Quicker than anyone. When I'm all alone in the great unknown, I'll remember you.
Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan on a new biography of Ralph Ellison. This is Fresh Air. Arnold Rampersad is a professor of English at Stanford who has written celebrated biographies of Langston Hughes and Jackie Robinson. Now Rampersad has turned his attention to the writer many people think of as having written the great American novel of the 20th century. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Rampersad's new biography of Ralph Ellison.
There have been some colossal writing blocks throughout literary history. Dashiell Hammett, Joseph Mitchell, Harper Lee, Henry Roth, to quickly name a few, all were bedeviled by decades-long bouts of blankness. But no writing block has ever been played out so publicly as the one suffered by Ralph Ellison. After his debut novel, Invisible Man, was published in 1952 and subsequently won the National Book Award, as well as an ongoing avalanche of honors for Ellison, there was, well, nothing, at least in terms of fiction. Ellison would visibly sadden or even flinch when an admirer would ask the awful question, "When's your next novel coming out?" In his authoritative, vivid biography of Ellison, Arnold Rampersad exhausts all the diagnoses, psychological, sociological, animal, and mineral, of why Ellison failed to produce a second novel. But there's no question that the one and only novel he did finish was a masterpiece. A contender for the great American novel, certainly of the 20th century, Invisible Man is one of those everything but the kitchen sink tales. It draws on Ellison's own life story, as well as jazz, folklore, classical mythology, African American history, off-color jokes, contemporary politics, and the work of American masters like Melville and Twain, as well as European modernists like Joyce. Except for the central section, which gets bogged down in Communist Party politics, Invisible Man manages not only to be encompassing and erudite, but also terrific fun to read. It became an impossible act for Ellison to follow, but not for Rampersad to match, in a sense, with this superb biography. In addition to chronicling Ellison's classic Up From Obscurity rise to fame, from his impoverished beginnings in Oklahoma to his eventual chumminess with presidents and captains of art and industry, Rampersad also serves up a rich account of 20th century American literary life. Ellison came to know almost everyone worth knowing in the New York literary world, and the constant boozy round of mutual backslapping and sniping with the likes of Richard Wright, both an early mentor and a later antagonist, Robert Penn Warren, Saul Bellow, Langston Hughes, Norman Mailer, and Amiri Baraka, no doubt distracted Ellison from the problem of his second novel. All throughout this biography, Rampersad offers shrewd commentary on Ellison's near-lifelong struggle to reconcile his racial identity with his universalist artistic ambitions. Ellison always said that he wanted genuine world fame, not condescending praise for being a good Negro writer. Ellison achieved that goal through Invisible Man, but got slammed, especially by an up-and-coming generation of black artists like Baraka, for being a sellout, in artistic thrall to high art palefaces like T.S. Eliot and Hemingway. Ellison's own demeanor didn't help matters. As Rampersad describes him, he was an aloof man and frequently ungenerous to younger black writers like Toni Morrison and Henry Louis Gates. But of course, he wasn't made of stone. In a telling anecdote, Rampersad describes a conference at Grinnell College in 1967 where Ellison was confronted by a guy dressed like a Black Panther. "You're an Uncle Tom man," shouted out the militant, "a disgrace to the race." The room of students and academics froze. Ellison shot back. "I resent being called an Uncle Tom. What do you know about my life? Get on your motorcycle and go back to Chicago and throw some Molotov cocktails. That's all you'll ever know about." As the Panthers and his buddies roared off on motorcycles, Rampersad quotes two separate witnesses who recall Ellison breaking down in tears and sobbing, "I'm not a Tom. I'm not a Tom." Later, Cornel West and other black cultural critics recuperated Ellison. The wheel turned, and for this next generation of black intellectuals, Ellison was black enough after all. Invisible Man ends when the unnamed hero, hiding underground, throws this question out to the reader. "Who knows but that on the lower frequencies, I speak for you. Just who Ellison spoke for or to, what diction he chose to speak in, what cultural symbols he reached for, these will always be vexed questions. The mystery isn't so much about the lack of a second novel. The mystery and wonder is that given all these landmines, Ellison ever found his way into writing that first novel at all.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed a new biography of Ralph Ellison by Arnold Rampersad. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Philip Roth. His novel Everyman is about a 71-year-old, multi-divorced, successful advertising man who is facing his physical deterioration and approaching death without the aid of religion or philosophy. It's now out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.